You're listening to a UC Davis Center for Poverty Research conference podcast. I'm the center's director, Ann Stevens. In October 2015, the center hosted the conference Employment, Earnings, and Inequality: Realities and Opportunities in Low-Wage Labor Markets. The conference featured experts on labor markets who presented both quantitative and qualitative research on a wide variety of topics, including wages, shifts in occupations, immigration, and the lives of low-skilled workers. Ken Jacobs moderates this policy discussion and Q&A on raising labor standards at the local level. Jacobs is the chair of the UC Berkeley Labor Center, where he has been a labor specialist since 2002.
I've been doing quite a bit of work over the last, 13 years since I've been at the center, and then before that, on both, started out at the center doing work on local labor standards, spent a lot of time on health care, and then later Affordable Care Act implementation, and then more recently back looking at labor standards, local labor standards, specifically with all these increases we're seeing at the minimum wage on the local level. And so what I want to do is talk about this turn to local government. Why is that? What's happening, and why is that happening? Get it a little bit into the impact on local minimum wage laws, and since we've talked about some of those issues, we'll go through that a bit, but I want to give a little more sort of macro perspective on some of that, and then go into what are some of the policy issues that people are facing as they're turning in and focusing on these local level policies. So obviously we've talked about this in terms of motivating all of this. Real wages have fallen at the bottom as they've increased at the top, with the biggest declines in the lowest 30%. And during the same time, of course, as we've seen, the real value of the minimum wage has gone down. During this time, again, we've seen this big turn to local around labor standards. This is an area that for a long time in the post-World War II period going on, they sort of considered that this is national level policy. So what's pushed it to the state and local level? And a key part of that, of course, is politics, since nothing's likely to happen to address income inequality and low-wage work at the national level. That's we saw an initial push in the 90s. And then, again, quite a bit more recently, with a focus on state and local level as a place where something can happen. Another key part of this recently in terms of the local minimum wages is, of course, the fight for 15, the organizing among fast food workers that's really changed the people's sense of both what's needed and what's possible as you've had workers in motion who are making these kinds of demands. The other part of the politics on this is, I think there was a period of time where you saw a lot of focus, or going in with Democrat Leadership Council, sort of neoliberal, saying, all right, let's do taxation and redistribution was the more economically efficient way to go with dealing with poverty. And then we had a big backlash to that, Mitt Romney and the 47%, and a real pushback there. And it's created more focus recently, again, on what Jacob Hacker called distributional policies, but focusing on things like that move to raise wages rather than waiting in the after the fact. And based on some of this morning's discussion, I think there's an important point there, that there's also some level of dignity connected with this that we see that plays out in the politics, where you have, but while you have lower levels of support for things like raising taxes and raising programs for the poor, you have very high levels of support, public support, across the political spectrum. I'd say on the first, it's a real Democrat-Republican divide. On the other, in terms of the minimum wage, you have support across the political spectrum with high support from Republicans as well on the idea of work being rewarded. The other piece on the local level is that it's not just about politics, but there is some economic sense behind this in the idea that what's the proper minimum wage for a city like San Francisco is just going to be different than what's the proper minimum wage for Modesto or California versus Mississippi. So there is an argument here that, in fact, there's a rationale for having variability in minimum wage. And just for those of us who've been working with this for a while, having President Obama in 2014 say, call on not just states but local governments to act was sort of a watershed. And you can really see this in this chart that, San Francisco and Santa Fe acted early with local minimum wage laws, and then just the last few years, it's off the chart. And there's quite a few cities who are considering it now. Now, that's not legal in every state. Many states don't allow cities to do their own minimum wage laws. So there's some real geographic variation with heavy concentration in California and especially the Bay Area. But we do see some throughout the country. And it's not only a question, and when we look at local labor standards of minimum wage, this shows paid sick leave. They've got four states plus these cities here have their own paid sick leave policies. Again, San Francisco being the first. San Francisco's really been the place that's done the most in this area. Started in the mid-1990s with equal benefits for domestic partners, for city contractors and people operating on city property, and then moved there from there through a bunch of contractor-related policies to finally doing across-the-board minimum wage, paid sick leave, a healthcare security ordinance, which requires a minimum spending per worker per hour on healthcare, varying by firm size. And then more recently, minimum wage, a new minimum wage increase that'll go up to $18 an hour by 2018, and a predictive scheduling or law that just passed that requires premium pay if schedules aren't given in advance or are changed at the last minute. And that was a recognition that, and we're seeing more and more focus in the predictive scheduling area. There's some people here who've done research on this area about the impacts of people having their work schedules changed at the last minute or not having set schedules on the ability to go to school, care for children, care for parents, et cetera, hold multiple jobs. So we're seeing this big push of different kinds of policies, labor policies at the local level, which means we're getting an incredible amount of variation. So there will be lots for you to study for quite a while. So don't worry about employment. So we've done prospective impacts on a number of those local minimum wage laws. Like there's six that we've done in California. The final law that was passed in Los Angeles was 15 by 2020 for large firms, 2021 for small firms. So it's a little bit less than this. Contra Costa and Sacramento were proposed. Those aren't, those actually haven't been passed. But what's important here, as you can see, both we're seeing higher levels of minimum wage. Of course, Seattle is the first to do something that'll reach 15. But higher levels of minimum wage, a real variation giving on the cost of living in those cities or median wages, current wage structure in those cities, of the impact. So San Francisco, even at $15 an hour in 2018, affect the bite is a little less than a quarter, and it brings the minimum to median wage, full-time wage ratio up to just 46%. And you can see most of these are still within the historic range. The U.S. at its height was 54% in 1968. The OECD average is around 50%. England, U.K. is about to go up to 60. L.A. is the one here that is really off that chart in terms of going much higher. 41% of the workforce we estimate to be affected. Average increase $4,800. So that is going to have a very large effect. In looking at who's affected, it's all workers over 20. You know, you've got 3 to 6% teens, majority of workers, affected work. This is the share of family income that comes from the affected worker. So everywhere but Contra Costa was over 50%, and there it was 47. And the other thing that, of course, stands out for California is everywhere it's disproportionately Latino. And if we add people of color all together, it's a very high percentage of people of color who are affected. In terms of industries, very concentrated in terms of where the big effects are within food service, healthcare and social assistance, retail, trade, and under this administrative and waste management service, well, what's that? The things that's driving this are things like temp agencies, janitorial, and security. The kinds of low-wage service jobs that you would expect. And what's important here is these jobs tend to be location-specific, so they're not the kinds of jobs that they're generally in non-tradables is where you see the wage increases going, which is important in thinking about the impacts. This is for LA, of course, which, you know, with having the highest wage increase here. But if you look at overall change in payroll cost, even at the 15 This is on the economy overall, even at the $15 an hour, it's about 3.8%. Given the share of labor costs, its operating cost, you get to 23%. So the overall change in operating cost is a little less than 1%. In all of those other cities, it's well below 0.5%. That's for the economy as a whole. Just showing overall, when we're looking at that and change in firm costs on the economy as a whole, it's small, but it can be much larger in specific industries, and in food services is where we see the biggest impact, again, with LA close to 8%. San Francisco is about 2.3%, just to give a comparison. So looking at San Francisco and what happened there originally, if you take all the laws that were in place by 2014, the effective minimum compensation for a large firm in San Francisco is already $13 an hour compared to $8 California minimum wage or in the surrounding areas before this recent movement in minimum wages. The good news is you do see the impact on wages. So right after it's passed, we see in the hourly adjusted wages going up in the lowest 10% of San Francisco workers, where it's flat and then declining in the surrounding counties as we hit the recession. So the wage increase did what it was expected to do. And of course, if we expect employment impacts, you'd think restaurants would be the place you'd get the most. So that's employment weighted average in surrounding restaurant employment in surrounding counties. And there's San Francisco during that same period. They basically track. So the general indication here is we don't see an impact, negative impact on restaurant employment in San Francisco. Now you're all thinking, well, that's San Francisco. Earlier, we were having a discussion. I've always thought of this as Sweden, but I guess I was told after the last debate, it's now the Denmark of America. So we'd go back to the discussion earlier about the Dubé, Lester, and Reich paper. The closest thing we have in terms of thinking about minimum wage and city impacts is to look at these cross-border impacts, and so this is some of the same stuff we looked at earlier in terms of where we see the cross-border variations, either where you've got no difference in minimum wage or you have a difference in minimum wage, and of course they find no measurable impact on restaurant employment. And just to say the important thing around using these methodologies is it allows you to capture geographic differences in pre-trends. If we look at high minimum wage and low minimum wage states from that period, you can see they're very distinct economic regions with different economic pre-trends going on in terms of growth, et cetera. And so by doing the cross-border studies, it enables you to do that control. So in terms of the impact on the economy, so we're not seeing the impact on employment. Well, what's going on? Good evidence on reduced employee turnover and improved employee performance. Turnover, there's a lot of research and looking in terms of what the savings are from there to firms. And we estimate that these laws are that about 15 to 20% of the cost is being absorbed through reduced turnover. I'll talk about the improved employee performance in a minute. Most of this is in terms of service quality. There isn't good estimates of the economic impact on that side. There's a question in terms of automation and substitution of capital for labor. In the kinds of industries where the minimum wage is binding are areas where we'd expect to see less of that. There's some research from Aronson on the restaurant industry where they find some changes in how labor is deployed, but not changes in overall employment. As wages go higher, this is something to be studied further. Good evidence on price increases. So this would be the theory, since you raise the floor for everyone, everyone has to follow the same rules. And in fact, both Aronson and then most recently colleagues Michael Reich and Sylvia Allegretto did a study on San Jose, where they do find a very strong increase pass-through into price in the restaurant industry. Going a 10% increase in the minimum wage is about a 0.5 to a 0.7 increase in prices. So a good share is being passed on into price. And we'd expect if price goes up, then demand, that should have some dampening impact on demand, decline in sales. But on the other hand, we've got money in people's pockets, and low-wage workers spend more of their income, and they tend to spend more of it locally. So that's, and there's some evidence also around borrowing as incomes go up. So that offsets the decline in demand. And when we modeled this out for Los Angeles, this is where this question about commute zones matters a lot, because when you're looking at a city, not all of the workers who work in that city live in that city, so some of that money is being spent outside of the city. So from a regional perspective, it all balances out, but within the city, you'll have some leakage in wealthy cities. That's okay. In less wealthy cities, that may have more of an impact. But in LA, we estimated a very small impact on employment within the city and a very small increase in employment in the county as a whole due to leakage. Then there's some other areas that are less well studied that are less well understood at this point. What is the impact on profits? Mixed research. Most of it hasn't found an impact, but there isn't really great methodologies that people have found to get at that. And then, especially on these local ones, where if the biggest impact is in retail and restaurants, we'd expect long-term there should be some potentially some impact on commercial rents and land prices, land values. That'll be, again, something to look at long term. So on the worker performance side, we interviewed employers at San Francisco National Airport after the minimum wage increased there, and had strong reports on the employers from improved work performance, better morale, less absenteeism, grievances, less disciplinary issues, improved customer service, and better equipment maintenance. And then the workers also reported they're putting more skill and more effort into the job. Hirsch and Zelaya did a similar study looking at a minimum wage increase in the Southeast and had similar kinds of results. Again, there's no sense of what's the economic value of that part has not been estimated, but it seems to be pretty clear. So what's all this mean in terms of then, you know, as local governments are thinking about doing these policies? There's a number of areas that are coming up strongly. One is an area that we've raised in a number of places are thinking about, which is regional coordination. We talk about, you know, there's a discussion about tinkering and the effects on workers. When we think about if all the cities in the area have slightly different minimum wages, that creates some decisions and both for workers and for firms, and in terms of the ability to just know what the law is. It also then has an impact on enforcement. So we think there's some real advantage to regional coordination, and what we're seeing right now is all the cities in Napa County and the county are all in discussion about doing the same thing. Similar discussions are going on in Contra Costa County about creating a model ordinance and then running it through, as well as in Santa Clara County. On the indexing side, all of the California city laws index, I think except Berkeley, which they're going to add in, most of the national ones do, and that creates that predictability rather than having the sort of jagged up and down when you don't do it on a policy basis, gives both workers and firms greater predictability. Enforcement is a key part of this, right? These laws don't just enforce themselves. Generally, enforcement is done at a state level or at a national level on labor and employment law, and so when cities are thinking about putting these laws into effect, they need to think about what's the enforcement side. So there's both a set of legal mechanisms that go within the law in terms of damages and penalties, so there's some reason not to violate and wait till you get caught. Most of the laws have private right of action, allowing lawsuits. Key part is protection against retaliation, so people aren't afraid to come forward. Notice posting and record keeping. And then San Francisco's done some innovative stuff around license revocation. One of the big issues on the state level is just collections. Once a firm, once violations are found, on the state level, very low share of that money is ever collected. So wage lien law just passed in, it was just signed by the governor, just passed in the state. But California has used, for restaurants, has used health licenses. I mean, in San Francisco, they've used health licenses. So basically, if there's someone who hasn't paid and their health license is up for review, the Department of Public Health will hold it until they've paid the back wages. And San Francisco has been very effective in collecting back wages. One of the other key things they do is allow for anonymous complaints that trigger audits so people don't have to come forward and have fear of retaliation, and then, of course, have an enforcement agents who speak different languages. So they have a good-sized enforcement agency, so there's some coordination there among state, local, and regional roles, and a local enforcement agency is necessary for both education and outreach so people know, in fact, both employers and employees know their rights, and then to carry out investigations. The other big innovation in San Francisco has been around community partnerships. The city of San Francisco funds, I believe it's now three local community organizations that do education and outreach within certain areas. So the Chinese Progressive Association working within the Chinese community. There's a Filipino community center. And just in the first few years, there was pretty slow ramp up in terms of the effect, but last year we saw more money collected from complaints brought by those organizations in net than from all of the complaint-driven side alone. So those they were bringing in larger cases and also had a good number of cases that resulted in some pretty big payouts. And that's where the cultural competency is so necessary in terms of people to have the feeling that they can come forward, that they won't lose their job, that they're willing to take those steps. One of the other big areas that's come out is looking at, and especially as wages are being raised at the local level, is the impact on nonprofits. And it's not just nonprofits, right? The share of nonprofit workers receiving wage increases tends to be lower than in the for-profit sector, and it's a highly diversified sector. So, you know, universities and hospitals, that's not where the issue is. It's really in the caregiving sectors, where within the human services, child care, developmental disability services, which is a mix between nonprofit and for-profit, you have services that are many of them are state-funded, where if a local city raises the minimum wage, the state doesn't necessarily change its reimbursement rates. So it's a big deal in childcare, where subsidy levels to childcare agencies have been for low-income families have been flat, and you've got these raising minimum wage. So if someone's doing home-based childcare and they're hiring 2-3 people in the house, and there's rules on ratios of how many people you have to have to how many kids, they're in a real bind. So one option would be to say, okay, well, why don't we just exempt the nonprofit organizations or exempt these care organizations from the laws? Well, we've got a lot of evidence, and we're discussing this earlier. I understand there was a paper presented yesterday on this around the relationship between quality jobs and quality care. That is, If wages are low in these care industries, turnover increases, and that affects care quality in very significant ways. But it's not just the nominal wage, it's the relative wage, right? So if everybody else goes up and these industries stay down, it's harder to attract workers, it's harder to retain workers and retain qualified workers, and that has a big impact on care. So what we've seen is the nonprofit organizations have generally, with one exception, lobbied, have supported minimum wage increases, but saying, and we need it to be funded. San Francisco has done some innovative work where it's actually created its own pool of funds to pay for the a wage supplement for childcare workers. Started this a little bit before the original first minimum wage law was passed, and then have increased it and built it out over the years. But this is something that other cities and states are really going to have to grapple with, that if we're going to change the wage structures in the care industries, which is needed for quality of care, then there's got to be a funding source. So if we say the big advantage of minimum wage is in the sense that it's all off budget, this is a place where it's going to need to be on budget. Other issues that have come up in some cities, Sacramento here most recently, there was a push around looking at not just wage but total compensation. And this is where I think the last presentation is really instructive around simplicity of law versus complexity. There was a point where I would have thought that some of this, especially, oh, you should count in health benefits, that makes sense, you don't want to create incentive structures around offering health care. It turns out once you do that, you raise all sorts of questions around valuation of health care, what counts as health benefits, and as soon as you start going down those routes, then you start getting products created to fit within certain of those structures, which means your enforcement mechanisms and capacity have to be much, much greater to follow up and be able to adjudicate and investigate in those areas. And so strong conclusion after having followed these policies for a number of years is simpler really is better. The beauty of the minimum wage is it's very clear. You can, in San Francisco, there are bus signs. Anytime you get on a bus, it says what the minimum wage is. Employers know it. Employees know it. And there's no confusion out there. And I think that overrides any of the possible benefits that you might gain. The other thing is, we found only a quarter of the workers who are affected by any of these minimum wage laws have health care on the job. And it's mostly in large firms that also have higher wage workers. And so you're much less likely to see an impact on the offering of health benefits. The other thing that's come up quite a bit is the question of tips and tip credit. Important to say, in California, tip credit is not permitted under California law. The tip is the property of the worker. It is not compensation from the employer. Many states, 43 states, do have tip credit. And this is an area of contestation right now. There's a lot of effort going on to eliminate that. It's important to note that poverty rates of people who earn tips are about twice the poverty rate of workers overall, heavily female jobs. Saru Jayaraman had a great piece in the New York Times about this the other day. And Silvia Allegretto, forthcoming paper on looking at because you have, if you think about when you bring in tips, you have a huge minimum wage variation given the sub-minimum wage for tip workers, which is $2.14 nationally. Huge variation across states. And so if that difference between $9 an hour and $2.14 in the other states would have a big impact on restaurant employment or use of screens rather than servers and all of that. We haven't seen that variation and that difference between tipped and with tip credit and non-tip credit states. But what's, of course, started to happen now as these minimum wages are going higher is there's a lot of some experimentation going on with eliminating tips, which in the end may turn out to be a positive thing overall. So in conclusion, with little expectation of movement at the federal level, I think we're going to see, at least for the next decade, state and local governments are going to be the locus of measures to address income inequality and low-wage work. It's hard to... Sometime next decade, we could see some change, but I think most of this is we're going to see focus at the local level. The best research evidence to date finds that state and local minimum wage policies are having their intended effect of improving earnings for low-wage workers. But the research is all based on much smaller wage increases than in terms of what we've seen in the past than what's now going into effect in the future. And so more research is needed to understand the impacts. And it's not just on the question of employment, which is the one that's been mostly studied, but there's a whole other host of areas where there's going to be some fruitful research to be done in terms of understanding what are the impacts of these higher wages. And so, I said that earlier, but I think for lots of people out here looking, in terms of looking at the research possibilities into the future, there's going to be, we're going to have lots of variation that people can exploit in their their research, and lots of important areas to understand. How do the higher minimum wages affect health, right? We do know from the literature, we'd expect that there's impact both on the worker's health and on their children's health. We know literature would tell us impact on children's educational outcomes over the long run. So there's been various experiments in this area, but there's a lot more that can be looked at. All the issue of interaction between, as discussed earlier, between higher minimum wages and the various program benefits, and how does that play out, etc. And so I think the incredible thing that we have going right now is, just to leave you with, there is a lot happening, a lot that we expect to continue to happen. beyond mentioning these local minimum wages, Cuomo has pledged in New York to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Looks like there may be a $15 an hour ballot initiative in California is a real possibility in this next year. Other states, Oregon is looking at 13 something, others at 12. So I think we're going to see quite a bit happening at the state and local level, and not just in the minimum wage space, but again, all these other forms of labor standards. And it's going to be important to understand how that plays out in terms of people's perception of work and job satisfaction to all of these other areas. So I look forward to seeing all of your research in the next decade. Questions?
Wondered about with all the new local minimum wages is normally economists would worry more about these policies in small geographic areas because there are just more avenues for firms. It doesn't even have to be firms moving, workers moving. But I haven't actually heard that talked about very much.
It comes up. When you look at what are the issues that come up in the local discussions, I think that beyond the ones I mentioned, just say a lot of concern about differential effects on small businesses versus large businesses. We don't have good research yet to know the answer to that question. This question of firm movement comes up. I think part of it, what's important to look at where the bite is the strongest, tends to be in, janitors and security guards aren't moving. Restaurant, location, location, location. Retail, there is a cost to being farther, and that's all been measured well, but in most of these cases, the impact on overall operating costs are smaller than some of the other things we might see in those local economies. So there is if you had a city that had a large export industry, like in Los Angeles, there still is a remnant garment industry. It would not surprise any of us if those firms were to move over the border. Now, then you still have the same number of jobs in the overall regional economy. It's a small number of jobs. You could decide, well, that's okay compared to the bigger picture. But right, if you've got cities if you had a city that still had a large low-wage manufacturing base, I think you'd be having you'd be thinking about this differently than a city where you're mostly looking at location-specific type jobs, which gives the importance of really granular analysis that it's important to look at what's the economy of the area that's considering it. And we, when it gets to these really small cities, Emeryville just passed the highest minimum wage in the country. My guess is that we'll see a reduction in commercial rents out of that. But, it's hard to hard to know.
So in terms of the sort of research, and I don't know the evidence on it. I wonder whether you do. And then the other one I wanted to ask you about. That one is the staging. So a whole bunch of these, as you put up those numbers, they're not going to happen at $15.
Correct.
A lot of them are going to take years. It seems to me one of the things we don't know very much about is whether when you stage a minimum wage in over that long a period, does that in some ways reduce the employment impact relative to anything we would get out of the estimates that we get now?
I think it's a really good question. Part of the motivation behind the moving it slowly up is that, but it's also there's one of the other papers by Aronson looks at the impact on firm turnover. So they did a paper and found they didn't find any impact on employment, but they did find an impact on firm turnover rates. So small businesses are going out of business constantly, and they found a peak right after the minimum wage. So those who can't adjust aren't able to adjust, go out of business, a new firm comes in, and so. There's a rationale to minimize those business shocks. The idea is that you may or may not end up with the same total employment at the end, but if you do a smoother glide path, you may be less disruptive to existing firms. Is some of the thinking behind that? But it's a good. It's because some of them came in quicker than others.
Yeah.
That's something that could be looked at on both of those fronts: overall employment and firms.
But the other one is the one. So you were talking about the effect of the minimum wage on reducing turnover. and you were sort of calculating that as, oh, how much does this save the firm in some sense? But I want to push for that, and this is maybe something you already know about that I don't know about. So we have some work for this on Canada, and what we find is that when the minimum wage goes up, in fact, layoffs go down. So it's not just that it's quits. Now, the one way you can rationalize that, there's this old paper by Jerome Ace Moglu where it's essentially a search and bargaining model. There's sort of good firms and bad firms, and they can coexist, you know, exactly as in those kinds of models. The bad firm has a lot more turnover but pays a lower wage. The good firm doesn't have turnover costs but pays a higher wage, and they can coexist in an equilibrium, right? And then what a minimum wage does to some degree is it prices out of business the sort of bad mm-hmm. job approach to any business. And I guess I was wondering whether that's, you know, you started talking about the firms you were looking at, and I guess I wonder whether that's potentially behind what we're finding in terms of decreased layoffs, that you push firms towards a different...
I think that is part of the... I mean, it's interesting, so Zeynep Ton's work on this in terms of the good job strategy and looking at these, that you can have high road and low road firms that it isn't just competition on quality, but even in the area where they're competing on price because you're using those different models. And I think that is part of what is likely going on is that the firms who are... You're changing the parameters on which people are operating, the regulatory structure, and that the firms who are able to... that have a higher road model... are the ones who are going to better survive and function, and those who have a low road model and can't make that transition are going to be driven out, and other firms are going to come in. I'm trying to remember, because the search frictions and job turnover paper that Michael Reich and Aaron Dubay did...
They don't have layoffs versus quits. They write down a model where they assume that it's quits. So they essentially write down this kind of Burdett and Morgan's model.
Right.
And then they assume that people are responding, even though in the long run, in those models... In our data, you can actually start breaking this down, and it's like three-quarters, two-thirds of it is in layoffs, not quits.
Fascinating. I said the other interesting thing we were talking about over lunch was in the Candace Howes in our book on San Francisco has a paper on home care workers, and there, because she was looking at length of match, and when the living wage law passed and the union won the higher wage for home care workers, you see big increase in length of match, and that's linked to all these quality care indicators. And then as the minimum wage goes up, that goes down a little bit, and it was the relative wage tracked very strongly there. But.
Yeah, just along the lines of regulation, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the importance of regulation and making sure that some of these minimum wages are actually binding in the sense that jobs like Uber or like informal jobs that seem like they're growing tremendously and they're not regulated according to the traditional minimum wage laws. So to the extent that people are moving to those jobs, then we just might not, even if the minimum wage is at $15-$16 an hour, it might not really be relevant in 5 or 10 years.
So first, that is a real and important phenomenon in terms of what's happening and in the whole 1099 economy. And so that is a sector where thinking about regulation and how that relates is going to be a very important sector, absolutely, in terms of it, as Uber and other, Uber's looking into moving into these other areas. Now, it's important to note, Uber took jobs of cab drivers who were always independent contractors. Most of the data sets don't show an increase in self-employment. There's a lot of question here, and I think Paul, are you working on some of that? And other?
I'm going to complain about exactly what you're saying. I'm
yeah. Okay. So, the overall restaurant workers are work for employers. Janitors and security guards work for employers. Most of these areas that we're seeing that are affected by these laws have those relationships, and we would expect them to continue to have those relationships, which isn't to say that there aren't parts of the economy where those kinds of things are happening and they're important to analyze and understand and look at the regulatory framework on. So I think as we think about this stuff in the future, it's important to think about both sides of it. There has been some tendency for people to say, the robots are coming, no one has a job anymore, let's do all universal benefits, let's forget about the employer relationship. I think that's a mistake. I think that all of those other, I support universal programs, I think all those other things are important places to go and to look at, but I think the employment relationship in some form will be durable for some real period of time, and that these things will continue to matter. But in and of themselves are not sufficient. The other thing that's important to note here is minimum wage appears to have, the minimum wage has its intended effects. It's a positive policy for low-wage workers. Minimum wage by itself cannot solve the problem of income inequality in the United States. It is one tool in a toolbox that needs to be much, much larger. And so because it's got such public support, it's the place we're seeing people going. We've got high support among Republicans, minimum wage laws passing by voters in red states, all of that. But I think much more is going to need to be done to look at other policies to how do you address some of this decline in the middle, all of these other areas. So this is one piece and should be seen and understood that way.
Sort of building on that, the minimum wage is not tied to the real cost of living for an individual. And there's a lot of talk about the issues around self-sufficiency wage, and there's various calculators that really look, and they're really geographic specific. They look at the real cost of living in a specific county or region. And is there any talk about actually looking at having a relationship between the minimum wage and a self-sufficiency wage?
So two answers to that. One is, for people who know their minimum wage history, if you go back to the original minimum wage laws a little over 100 years ago, this stuff is really fun to look at. They were only binding on children and women under the idea that men had the ability to have free contract, right? So it's unconstitutional to interfere with that contract. But since women and children didn't, you could set a minimum wage for them. And the minimum wage was set based on the basket of goods needed by a single woman. So if you go back to the original IWC orders in California, and I encourage you to look at these, they have, here's what the basic cost of living is for a single woman in the state. And it was in 1914, I think it was 14 cents an hour. I may have the year and the amount slightly off, but it was right around that. So there is some history there, but putting it on the other side, if you did that and you looked at that, and one, you've got different self-sufficiency standards for a single person and with kids, etc. And two, some of those numbers start getting very, very high. And I can say, look, we've got all this good evidence that minimum wage of the size we've seen in the United States today has not had a statistically significant impact on employment. There is some point where that will begin to change, and when you start going to those self-sufficiency levels, especially if you're looking at a single parent or where those numbers, in some of these cities get very high, it's just one tool. And this is where when you really want to think about the mix of minimum wage and EITC and child care and health care and, a basket of things that you put together, you're more likely to get there. I think Brad DeLong had a really nice piece on this in terms of that, wrote the other day around the EITC minimum wage balance. And we don't know exactly what the right balance is, but it's important to keep in mind this is not an unlimited area that you can just go as high as you want, as much as one would wish.
I was wondering about how big changes, especially the minimum wage, might change the composition of the workforce who is earning a minimum wage, because especially with the talk earlier about how maybe more educated people are getting pushed down the skill ladder, are we just going to... could you see employers kind of trade out low-skill workers for higher-skill workers who are now... $15 an hour is probably more than I make now. So, if I was... I could maybe see that.
So this gets to the question about what matters more, status or money, right? But, right. Well, so that is this question of labor substitution is an important question, and if you've got a minimum wage on a a state level the size of California, I think that's going to be less of a concern. You might draw people in the state, but that is where you come into, okay, if you've raised a wage in one geographic place and so you've got a bigger commute shed, could more workers?
But to follow up a little bit about secondary earners, right? The people who might choose to opt out or opt into the labor market and then crowd out.
Sure. That's right. So you have that, and you also might have people opting out of the labor market because now what we saw a little bit with the affordable, with the healthcare expansion, the 26-year-old, is some people could opt out of the labor market. Now they didn't have to work to get their healthcare, so they could go to school. So some of these dynamics could move in multiple ways. We looked at this very specifically with the San Francisco International Airport, because that was a sizable wage increase. And so we had very good data on the security screeners. This was before 911. And in the before and after, there was no statistically significant change in workforce demographics. Actually, we looked at, it wasn't just the security screeners. We had badge data, so we were looking at across a whole host of occupations. The only place we saw a change, which was interesting, was it wasn't statistically significant, but. Take it with it, whatever, was there appeared to be a decline in women working in traditionally male jobs. And so, there's sort of, if we think that's true and what happened, then they go, well, there's two possibilities. One is more men applied for the job and just so just a standard selection would end up with more men and fewer women. Or before there was a latent desire for discrimination, but you couldn't discriminate because you didn't have enough job applicants to discriminate, and now you could. I don't know how you would differentiate between those two responses, but it was very small. Now, this was only after 1 year, and so I guess there'd be some question, but we didn't see effects on education, race, gender. There could be unobservables there, and that's there's no way, obviously, to know.
By adding a comment that wouldn't the biases against having a PhD, if I'm hiring at Starbucks to have a barista, am I going to still assume, even though it's $50 an hour, the PhD student is going to stick around versus the low school worker who doesn't have the high school education or college education and might remain a loyal permanent employee for a longer period of time? I mean, the other biases also keep people from crowding out.
I know you only have a few more minutes, and mm-hmm. I guess I'll make myself the last question, but going back to the, I think it was maybe your second slide, or maybe it was even on the slide, the very beginning of your talk, you said something about legislation or an actual law change, I can't remember exactly what it was, or I didn't catch exactly what it was, about premium pay for unpredictable work schedules.
Yes.
And this is something Vicky was talking about in her lecture in my poverty and public policy class yesterday. It's something that's been coming up in the news, not the premium pay part, but the problems associated with these unpredictable mm-hmm. schedules. And this was the first time I heard about
right.
the possibility of doing something about it in a meeting. So I wondered if you could elaborate on that.
Sure. So there's been a lot of attention to the issue recently, and some very good organizing that's been going on by a Campaign for Popular Democracy and others, Jobs with Justice in San Francisco, on this, where people have been really raising these issues. And there's been some response, right? Starbucks announced they were going to change their policy. I guess there's been some question about how much that's actually changed. Walmart's announced that they're going to change their policy in the future. The Gap's taking some action. So in part, just having the issue out there and having lots of people organizing and taking these brands and shaming them appears to be having an impact. Well, it's had an impact on on what they state their policies are. I think we need to see what the impact is on actually how that's carried out and implemented. But in San Francisco, a law was passed addressing this. And what it does is, rather than giving the schedule that Sunday before the week, schedules have to be given 2 weeks in advance. Now, just to say, one of the key things that Susan Lambert in her research on this discovered is that the variation in overall hours worked in these restaurant and retail was much less than the variation for individual workers, indicating that there was quite a bit of capacity to have much more stable schedules. So then you go, well, why are they so unstable? And I think it has a lot to do with worker control in the sense of, you know, you get hours if you do everything as you're being asked to do and work at a high speed, et cetera. And at every moment, you're working in fear of losing hours, along with the issue of variation in work demand. And so what this does, it says schedules have to be set 2 weeks in advance. If they're not scheduled 2 weeks in advance, then there's premium pay. If there's someone calls in sick, then that they can replace, and there's no penalty there. There's other things that details in the law that allow for unexpected work, but it's used to overall stabilize the work. It's just going into effect now. And so I know of a couple of people who are thinking about or doing some work looking at this, but I think it's an area, again, that's going to be really important to look at, because lots of other... David Chu had a proposal in the State Assembly to do this California-wide. Lots of other places are grappling with this and looking at what's the exact right mechanism, because there are industries where supply and service demand does change, and you want some ability to handle that, but at the same time, to the degree possible, you want to stabilize schedules, and that's where people are working. Just the other thing is the California law only applies to a large chain retail. So that's it's restaurants, retail, banks would be included, but they have to be pretty large. So it doesn't apply to smaller businesses. And it is in those larger chains where you tend to have the rules set from the very top that says you have this budget to use for labor, you can't exceed this budget, and so there's a lot of pressure around hour manipulation. And so part of that is trying to push that back up. But I believe some of the stuff that happened in Starbucks was they announced the change in policy, but everyone else was still, the managers were still under this pressure to meet the demand, and so they were not making the it's harder to make those changes without some change in corporate policy on some of those other areas.
Thanks very much.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.